Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Rain Matter podcast. In this episode, we spoke to Osborne Saldana from EMVC. He is an ardent follower of the fintech space in India and globally. We spoke at length about various facets of fintech investing, his approach to finding the best founders out there, his view on the regulations that might affect fintech products in the next year or so. We hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Let's jump right in. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Rain Matter podcast. We've got Osborne today. Osborne is a principal at Emphasis Ventures, comes with close to a decade of investing experience. He's partnered with founders like Jar, M2P, Munai, Flash, and many others. Publishes two fintech newsletters, Fintech Inside and This Week in Fintech. Me and Mohit are both avid readers of this newsletter. And they're widely read in the fintech space. And he's also known for organizing a bunch of fintech events, which I've not been to so far, but I'll try to make it to the next one. But welcome, Osborne. Great to have you here. Cheers. So, you know, I'll start off with the general question that I ask maybe everybody who's on this podcast. And that's just about your personal journey, right? I mean, a lot of that background into how you are where you are today. If you want to, you know, kind of give us a glimpse into your work experience, your journey so far, that'll be very nice for the listeners.
Cool. So thanks for having me on the podcast. As you mentioned in the introduction, currently a principal at Emphasis Ventures. EMVC, we invest in very early stage fintech startups. And my journey, my professional journey has always been in venture capital. But I secretly call myself an accidental VC in the sense that I never wanted to be a VC at all. I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur, right? A founder building things that outlast me in some sense. And so, like, I'm an engineer by education. And so I've always wanted to build things. I always wanted to see products in people's hands and things like that. But in my quest of wanting to start up, I realized that I didn't know anything about finance or the regulatory or the other aspect of it or the background aspect of it, right? And so I said, why not I join some place that teaches me those kind of aspects and then maybe quit after a few years and then start up, right? So interestingly, I was just interning at one of the portfolio companies of the first place that I joined, which is Tuscan Ventures. And they saw my work, liked it, and then VC just happened that way. I didn't know what I was getting into in some sense. But yeah, when I joined them, they gave me the freedom and the space to experiment and do things the way I wanted to. Learned a lot, and now I think VC is my calling in some sense, or where I see myself for the for the future. And so VC just happened like that. And I've always loved partnering with founders and working with them to help them achieve what they want to achieve with regard to their startups, right? So Tuscan Ventures happened, then Xiaomi happened. With Xiaomi, I was investing in growth stage companies across India, Southeast Asia, and Europe. And then Emphasis Ventures happened in 2021. And so it's been just about 2 years now, partnering very early stage with founders over here.
Got it. No, I mean, before we move on to the next question, I have a follow-up. So, you know, most of the VCs I speak to, you know, most of them are accidental VCs, right? And because it is a very commonality between a lot of investors out there, I wanted to ask, you know, what was that one tipping point which kind of told you this is where I want to be? I mean, I'm sure that learning phase of it, having the freedom to kind of invest in these businesses, etc., would have had some pull. But I'm sure there was some moment where you said, you know, yeah, you know, I want to be in this space. Like, what was that one moment? Or is there a moment like that?
Yeah, I think the one moment which I distinctly remember is when I was meeting a payments company at Trident in Mumbai at BKC. And in the conversation, I ended up, like, I've always identified as an engineer, an IT engineer and things like that, right? But in that meeting, for some reason, I ended up saying, oh, you know, those engineers are so-and-so, or, you know. But I referred to engineers as someone else, as opposed to myself. You know, that in my sense, and that was like almost 3-4 years after becoming a VC in some sense. But aside from that one point where I reflected back and I was like, oh damn, I don't identify as an engineer anymore in some sense. But aside from that, I think there, the aspect of working with a lot of founders, working with or learning about different industries, oftentimes almost 3-4 different industries in the same day, for example, right? All of those aspects are some things that I really love doing. And at the same time, while also working with founders, I realized that I probably don't have the competence or the gumption to become a founder myself, you know, because there's so much that goes on with a founder that I was not sure I had it in me. But at the same time, I still wanted to be close to a founder and dream with them in some sense, right? But I think there were several aspects to this, me becoming into a VC and me loving the job that I do. But I think there was that distinct memory of mine where at that Trident and BKC meeting the specific company where I just referred to engineers as someone else as opposed to myself, you know.
Also, between like an engineer and a VC, like where do you think the perspective difference is coming from? So these 3 years that maybe like a difference in perspective was coming to you as maybe a difference in identity, like what would be that perspective change if you?
The perspective change was the engineer in me loved building products, right? I remember when I was in college, still, I joined engineering because I love coding, by the way, right? And not because of family or anything like that, but I really love computers and I really loved coding and all of that stuff. And so when I was in college, I used to love building, doing all the various projects that they made us do, right? Building an ATM machine or coding the entire ATM machine, coding a calculator and all of those various, you know, menial tasks that they make you do in projects for in college. So the engineer in me loved building those products. Now, whether those products were used by users or not, that was secondary, right? But I wanted to build something cool that I loved using. And even today, I will end up building like things just because I think they're cool and for myself, right? During the pandemic, I built like this random website called whattocook.today. It was just a meal generator, you know, because I didn't want to go through the hassle of thinking every day what to cook and all of that stuff. So during the pandemic, I just said, let me whip this up, right? So that mindset of the engineer was about building cool products. From a VC perspective, there are many other aspects around that product, which I realized, which I wanted to sort of talk about a lot more, right? The user adoption perspective, the market size perspective of it, the whether the founder is right for the kind of product that is being built. All of those aspects, I think from a perspective aspect of it, that expanded my view of things from just an engineer to all of those other aspects that I just mentioned, right? The other thing also, we just saw the Apple VR and AR headset release yesterday, right? One thing that I noticed throughout that release of the product, they didn't mention metaverse, they didn't mention artificial intelligence, they didn't mention all of those other things, technologies, which enable what Apple ended up releasing, but they didn't mention any of that because their users don't care about it, right? Their users ended up caring for how do I use this product? Why will it be beneficial for my life? Why should I spend $3,500 and things like that? So that understanding of the user and why will a user use a technology that you are building is something that I think comes at least from a VC perspective and expands that horizon, at least for me, which is what I love doing. And in some sense, it's more of an amalgamation of product with consumer and psychology of humans and all of that stuff, which really excite me to some extent. So
some of these things around looking at a product, valuing a business, trying to figure like where or if growth would come to the industry, if not the business specifically. From our perspective, like our day jobs, the Nationwide are at Charota. And in the secondary markets, we find that like bunch of parameters. So there's an already established industry, the competition companies that you can look at for relative valuation. There are similar products out there. You can figure based on that what the market size could be. In terms of the data available for one to analyze, like so many things there. And then you could like pick one or maybe like a combination of multiple things to figure what best works for your mode of analysis. But when it comes to analyzing a venture capital opportunity, when it comes to figuring out for a startup which might be in a space that doesn't even exist today, forget disruption. Do you like rely on intuition there, or is it more of a checklist of sorts that you've like manufactured for yourself over the last few years?
Sure, I think in some ways the only thing that you learn or you should learn as a VC is reading people, right? And reading founders more specifically. I think for me, because and I'm speaking from an early stage investing lens, right? It's different evaluation for different or investment evaluation for different stages. But just from my early stage perspective, I look at two main things, right? One is the founder execution capability. And second is the market size, right? Everything else is mostly just hygiene stuff that you look for. But from a founder execution capability, I ask them one main question, which I've also written about in the newsletter. But the question is, what is a unique insight you were able to develop about your user behavior that gave you the conviction to start up in this space, right? That unique insight comes from having spoken to hundreds of customers, potential customers and things like that. Unique insight doesn't come from you sitting in an AC room or anything like that. Unique insight doesn't come from looking at data either, right? Unique insight will only come from speaking to your potential customers or looking at how they use your product or use existing products to some extent, right? And it's not so simple also. I mean, building a unique insight is very difficult. But you have to constantly be evaluating how the user uses the product, how user uses competition product, how user goes about their day from a workflow perspective, asking the right questions, not just leading questions, but asking more thoughtful questions. All of those aspects are important. But the question that I ended up asking about this unique insight tells me a few things about the user, right? It tells me that the founder is rolling up their sleeves and going out into the market and asking their customers questions, as opposed to talking to other VCs and saying, hey, what's hot right now? Would you invest in something like this and things like that, right? It's useless. And so are they going out in the market and asking customers questions? Are they reiterating fast enough, right? The other aspect of this unique insight is also that in the early days, especially if you're a few weeks into your idea, it's kind of tough to develop a unique idea, a unique insight about your customer base. And so then as a proxy, what I look for is just the execution capability. Are they iterating fast enough? Are they learning faster than they are iterating, right? Those two are the main things. And so in my evaluation, at least from a VC perspective, again, early stage, if I like the idea, I will maybe suggest a feedback to the founder. If I really like the founder and the idea, then I will maybe wait for a week or 2 weeks and see if the founder has gone out and worked on the suggestion or idea or not, right? If the founder has gone to the market and come back to me and said, hey, Osborne, you gave me the suggestion. Here's why it worked or here's why it didn't work. You know, if it didn't work, here's X, Y, and Z reasons. That's something that I'm fine with, but that's something that tells me more about the founder than me, again, just evaluating based off of my judgment or preconceived notions and rules that I've developed over the years, right? But that founder capability is super important in my view, especially at the early stages. Market size is also important. It's very rare that you will get markets where there nothing exists today. Category creating stuff is just very tough. And category creating businesses are also extremely expensive because you are spending a ton of knowledge and work and money in just educating the user, right? So it's usually very rare, and therefore you need an excellent founder to build over there. But therefore, I don't look so much for category creating. I'm fine with you building in the same market as long as you are figuring out your own wedge to build and grow over there. But I've gone all over the place, but I hope that answers your question in some way.
Yeah, no, I have a follow-up to that. I think, you know, you mentioned a couple of things. So one is, you know, iterating the product faster. And the second part of it is just the learnability aspect of it. So aren't both of those a factor of how much the founder thinks that the problem is yet to be solved? Because, you know, my question is coming from the fact that there are a lot of these VCs out there who talk about, you know, supporting founders who believe that the problem is half solved when they're starting up a venture. Because, you know, if you feel that your solution, your app, your product, your platform is going to solve this problem once and for all, there's nothing more for you to do over the next 5 to 6 years. So, I mean, have you seen that play out with some of the startups that you interact with? You know, just the fact that these founders know that the problem is half solved and, you know, there's a lot more work to be done. Is that a factor of how much learnability is shown by these founders?
If I've understood your question correctly, you're asking that are founders learning quickly enough based off of the value that the VCs bring to them and therefore are executing, or?
No. So my question is more around the fact that, you know, if say a founder has a solution, has a product out there. Now, you know, if he feels that, you know, this is going to solve the problem once and for all, or like there's nothing more to solve for, then there's nothing more to learn for him. So do founders need to have this mentality that, you know, even though they're coming up with a solution for a problem, there's lots more to do? And I think that mentality is very rare to find it, because most founders, or say even me, for example, if I'm solving a problem, I would believe that, you know, this is done without knowing there are a lot more perspectives out there. There are lots more to kind of expand into, lots more to kind of learn about. So have you seen that happen with founders where, you know, when there is that whole idea and concept of, you know, there's still a lot more to solve for, they're more learnable, they're more malleable, they're more receptive to feedback. And
I think it's very rare for founders to have that kind of mindset. But at the same time, there's one thing that I truly believe, that the best founders who are malleable, who want to learn and all of that stuff, who are very execution heavy and things like that, all of those kind of founders, which I assume are the best founders, typically don't need any value add from their VCs, right? But then at the same time, those founders are always looking at execution and looking at the data, right? In VC, we have this saying that strong opinions weakly held and things like that, right? Usually, at least in my conversations with founders, we see that a lot of them come with a fixed idea, right? And they come to us saying that, hey, here's the solution because there's this problem and XYZ, right? But usually when I go and ask them more about the user behavior, right, that's where a lot of things fall apart. And so that's where you realize that the founder is not iterating fast enough, executing fast enough, and going and saying, okay, the user wants X, Y, and Z, right? And so it's a tough balance for even the founder, because a founder will usually have their own biases, and their biases will probably just make them assume that what they want to see in the world is what the world wants, right? And that is a very slippery slope for a lot of founders, which we see fairly often. And it's just human behavior again. But what I said about founder capability to some extent, I just look for which of those founders are going out to the market and saying, okay, this doesn't work and that works and things like that. To some extent, you're right. Majority of the founders aren't that way. But then it's just tough. And that's not to say, by the way, that they won't build a great business, right? All VCs aren't know-it-alls, right? They may act like know-it-alls, but not every VC knows everything. And so it's important for even us VCs to be humble about what we know about the market, right? And I may say now I have 10 years of experience, let's say, in financial services, and I know a certain way of how financial services should work, right? But if I go to a meeting and I say that, okay, this lender is never going to partner with you, you're toast. And so what's the point in even building something like this? I need to have the humility to instead say that, okay, this is what I believe. I think definitely go and figure out how you can close this. If not, what's your backup plan, right? And so if the founder goes out and says that, no, I believe that I can close that lender and works towards it, then I'm happy to be proven wrong in some sense, you know. Does that help answer?
Yeah. No, that does. So, you know, let's go into some of the questions that you maybe have spent lots of time on. So I'll start with the UPI. So, you know, just wanted to get your general sense of what's happening here. I think there's lots more being said. I think everybody knows, you know, about UPI now. If you go to tier 3, tier 4, tier 5 cities as well. So it's very popular. But, you know, with all the talk about lending, credit on UPI, international transactions, account aggregator, you know, all of, there's lots being said about these topics, but what is it that you're taking interest in? I know you've written about all of these, but there has to be one favorite child amongst all of this. And what are you most excited about?
What am I most excited about from new innovations that are coming out from the public stack?
Yeah. You know, specifically about UPI, you know, if you want to. But even if it's anything apart from UPI, you know, more than happy to kind of listen to that.
Would not have realized the kind of impact that UPI would have had. And so I'm fairly optimistic and intrigued by what UPI can do for the country, right? And on those similar lines, I think credit on UPI is the most exciting thing about UPI these days. From my perspective, we all know that India is a credit-starved country, and the macro of India from a personal or retail credit perspective and even an SME credit perspective, we all know the macro indicators over there. There was a stat that I had heard, that I had read back in 2015 or so. I don't know if it's still true, but only 1 in 7 loans that were being disbursed back then was a formal loan, right? And so I'm sure things have changed now over the years over there. But if you, there was another report that was released by one of the credit bureaus in the country, which said that the total digital lending in the country is just about $10 billion or so, right? 70,000-80,000 crores around that mark. And so while it's large and it's brought digital lending from a long way from where we were a few years ago, we've still got a long way to go from here, right? And so credit on UPI could be that fix, I guess, at least from my understanding perspective. The form factor of credit on UPI is something that Indians have never seen before. The other aspect also is that the form factor of a credit card from a plastic perspective using that card is not familiar for a lot of Indians, right? It's familiar for the top 0.5% of India or all of us living in tier one cities. But for mass India or majority of India, they don't know how to use cards, for example. We've all seen when everyone was issued a Jan Dhan account back when it was, they were all issued a debit card, right? And if you stood outside an ATM, SBI ATM or whichever, you would realize that they don't know how to use that ATM card, right? Or that debit card to some extent. And so that is one aspect where a lot of Indians aren't familiar with the form factor of a card. The other aspect also is that a lot of Indians don't trust the card, right? There are safeguards by RBI with regard to PIN and all of those aspects, but still there is a bit of hesitancy from a lot of people, especially mass India, with regard to using a card at a merchant store or at a restaurant or wherever else that may be. And so those two main things are what's capping the growth of card form factor and therefore credit in India. personal loans and all of that, we all know the kind of limitations that there are with regard to banks issuing credit cards, with banks issuing loans and all of those aspects, right? So the macro of India, therefore, continues to remain the exact same as it was a few years ago. Credit on UPI could really change that, right? And that's not to say that there are no challenges with regard to credit on UPI at the same time. My hesitation with credit on UPI is only that the user who's using credit on UPI may not know that it is a credit option being used at the point of sale, for example, right? And that can create a lot of issues with regard to collections, defaults, and therefore credit scores of Indians as well. And so there are many things that need to be figured out as we go along with regard to credit on UPI. But I think from a retail perspective, and more importantly, from an SME perspective, if there is a better product in the form factor of a UPI for credit, I'm super excited about that.
Currently, there's like a very big gap between all of the development, everybody in the ecosystem, in the UPI ecosystem has done, and the sort of value that they have been able to generate for themselves in terms of profits that they can take out of the system or revenue that they can get from the system. With credit on UPI, do you feel like everyone in the ecosystem is like going to have a singular focus on, because that's that one monetization sort of avenue for UPI?
Yeah, I think that is still left to be seen, honestly. Because so far, at least on UPI front, the MDR or the commissions were mainly driven by the government, right? Credit on UPI, I guess, has a lot of other issues with it with regard to MDR. And therefore, I don't know if there is a clarity on how the various entities will end up earning from it, right? From what I understand, credit card on UPI will not go on credit card rails, right? And if that happens, then the infrastructure of the card network, the issuing, the acquiring bank, and all of those aspects doesn't come into play. And therefore, the MDR as well might not be as much. So there are a lot of nuances to credit on UPI, which are yet to play out and yet to be agreed on by the industry, which is why I don't have full clarity on that aspect. Sure, it is one area which a lot of the industry participants are hoping that MDR will not be capped or will not be free and things like that. But it's left to be seen. We're too early in that journey, I guess.
For somebody who's like uninitiated with respect to some of the terms we've been using right now, let's say MDR or the credit card rails, do you want to like set context? What MDR means,
Sure.
The credit card rails are?
Sure, sorry about that. But MDR is merchant discount rate. It is a fee that is charged on the transaction value when a digital payment is made, right? In cash payment, for example, there is no entity in the middle that facilitates the transaction between me and my chaiwala, for example, right? I directly pay cash to the chaiwala and that's it, right? There is no handling cost. There is no processing cost. There's nothing else, because there is no entity in the middle that's ensuring that the chaiwala receives the money that I do, right? So that's in offline settings, at least for cash. But in online payments, there are entities in the middle, and there are almost 4 to 5 such entities in the middle that ensure that the dance of payments and data and all of that stuff goes in sync and ensures that the merchant ends up receiving the kind of money that I'm paying them, right? So if it's 100 rupees, MDRs for different types of payment or merchant discount rates for different type of payment modes will be different, right? For UPI, it's free. For debit card, it's capped up to 1%. For credit cards, it is not capped and so can go up to 2 to 3%. For Amex and things like that, it can go as high as 7 to 10%. So it's all variable, but at the same time, there is a cost in between that someone has to bear because there are entities that facilitate the processing of that. And more importantly, I think the entities in the middle are also doing a lot more work with regard to fraud management, with regard to KYC, with regard to data exchange and all of those aspects. And therefore, they need to be paid, right? So that's MDR. credit card rails are basically card networks in some sense, right? Card networks are your Visa, MasterCard, RuPay, and Amex, and all the others that are there in the country, just about 4 to 5 that are there approved by RBI, right? So credit card basically functions between two banks or the same bank, but the card network in the middle is what is tokenizing the payment. I just realized I added another term which people might not be familiar with, but anyway, so I'll get to that. So the card network itself is bringing on board its network of various banks that doesn't require me to, as a user, add my merchant or my chaiwala's bank account details, right? Without entering bank account details, the card network is facilitating the payment transaction. So that's a card network. And therefore, what I was trying to get at with regard to credit card on UPI was that the card transaction, when I use my credit card on UPI, from what I understand, the UPI transaction for credit does not touch the card network or the entities in middle for the credit processing. It just flows via UPI rails and therefore processed accordingly. Does that help?
I think like there can be a simple example that we can also share. So let's say you are going to a shop to buy an article and you pay 100 rupees to the shop owner. Now, the MDR that we're talking about is the charge to the shop owner for getting that transaction. So when you pay cash to the shop owner, whatever you pay directly goes to like them, and there's no charge for it. When you also do a UPI transaction right now, regulations don't allow for a charge. But let's say you've paid via a credit card and assume the shop owner is being charged 2%. Now all these entities in between, if you have a Visa credit card that's like from your bank, now your bank is involved, the bank of the merchant is involved, the card network, which is Visa, is involved. All of them take a share from the merchant. So the merchant ends up paying for it. Why does he pay for it? Why can't he just like sell you in cash? Because a lot of people demand it. It's convenient. So to make sure that the sales is like flowing through, and because of want of cash, it's not stopping, it leads to higher sales for the merchant as well. So he's winning. And the entities here who are facilitating the payment are also adding some value, getting payment for it. I mean, that's like largely how the setup works. Now, what Osman was also mentioning was on the UPI front, it might not work the same way. So the card entities involved here might not be facilitating the transaction the same way they're doing it currently. So because that might be different, the commercials might also be different for it.
Yeah. It's also us getting too technical about this. yeah, so from what I, again, understand, when I am making a payment to my chaiwala with using credit card on UPI, the payment just uses the UPI flows and therefore doesn't touch the card network and therefore doesn't require as high an MDR or a merchant discount rate as would be with a typical credit card transaction.
Yeah. Now, switching to something that you already spoken about. So, in fintech, I think for the past year and a half, I think all that we've been hearing about is lending, right? You know, all roads lead to lending. I mean, I think there have been a lot of chatter around that, saying, you know, if you're a fintech, if you've got to make money, you'll have to lend. Will there ever be sustainable business models with fintechs, at least specific to India, without lending? I mean, are there opportunities that you see over the next couple of years, maybe? Because, you know, this can evolve. And, you know, that's exactly what happens in industries like this, is that, you know, the moment you realize that, you know, there's only one way to go about it, something else pops up. So are you expecting fintechs to depend solely on lending for the next few years? Or do you feel that something is definitely around the corner? Something else, something new, maybe.
This is a 10-mark question. but I think there's so much still to be done in fintech generally across the spectrum of financial services. that opportunity is really everywhere we can see, right? From a lending perspective, to some extent, while I believe that there are opportunities in other sectors of financial services, with respect to everyone else, I don't get why people say, oh, this person is only lending, or this company, like, they'll add on lending and they will grow their business from a revenue perspective and all of that stuff. Like, what's wrong with lending to an extent, right? Kunal Shah famously said that lending is a feature to a lot of companies. And so why not add lending as a feature in your product, right? We all, I think in my newsletter, I've also written that even with regard to banks, right, 70% of their revenues come in from lending, or maybe more in some smaller banks as well. If the peak of financial services, which is like banks, are able to earn 70-75% of their revenue from lending, you know, what will other companies do by doing other smaller by launching other smaller products to some extent, right? Lending is a big cash cow for a lot of businesses, and there's nothing wrong with that as well, right? So I think lending will continue to be a large portion, at least from a revenue perspective, for companies that aren't specifically into financial services, right? Even from a company that is lending, I think that is their, bread and butter. And therefore, they will end up doing a lot more innovation on the product itself with regard to, and there's still a lot of innovation left to be done with regard to onboarding, with regard to underwriting, with regard to collections. There's still so much to be done other than just the plain vanilla disbursal, right? And therefore, there's still a lot more innovation left to be seen in the space, at least from my perspective. This I'm saying with regard to the retail side of things, as well as the SME side of things, or the small business side of things, right? But at the same time, that doesn't mean that the opportunity is only in lending, at least from an investments perspective, right? The opportunity still, I believe that there is an opportunity in B2B payments, for example, right? Where there's still a lot of problems to be solved in B2B payments. And it's really not simple processing that you do for retail payments at the same time. So B2B payments, I still believe that there is an opportunity, and large businesses can be built over there, right? I believe that there could be an opportunity for vertical payments as well, right? If you think about it, the past 10 years of payments has largely been designed around commerce, right? If you think about it, the biggest companies or customers of a payments company are e-commerce companies. But that does not mean that there is no opportunity with regard to, let's say, healthcare payments or logistics payments or any of those other sectors as well, right? There are the only difference is that the value chain for those other sectors is different, right? And therefore, you cannot just latch on the existing payment rails that we've built and say that, hey, hospital, use the same payment rails and you'll build it out, right? So that payments for a vertical business needs to be rethought, right? On similar lines, even agriculture is a big industry that the payment cycles are just ridiculous over there, right? And the payment flows are just kind of crazy. And so opportunities, again, in agriculture to some extent. Insurance, I believe, is a hugely undertapped kind of opportunity for fintech startups. Right from, again, the manufacturing side, where they become general insurance or life insurance companies, right up to brokers, to distributors, to all of those other places across the insurance value stack, where there are opportunities to build large businesses. And in some parts, this has been because of the regulator as well. But I think that is changing since last year. And there are opportunities that are opening up in the insurance space. Wealth, there are opportunities, but I don't know if they'll be large enough at this time from a revenue perspective. But there are still challenges with regard to wealth management for India, right? It needs to be solved. Now, how those will be solved and all of those things needs to be figured out. As I said, I have this keyboard and my screen and this newsletter, and so I keep posting stuff from my newsletter. But at the end of the day, it's founders that inform a lot of what I write over there, right? It's founders that end up figuring out a lot of these things because they are in the thick of things. And so speaking with founders is like the best thing I can do. And those are opportunity sets. I mean, other than the speaking to founders bits, there are a whole bunch of opportunities for fintech startups that I believe are existing. And the next 10 years of fintech in India will look completely different from the last 10 years of fintech in India, right? And I'm here. I'm excited.
It's a good time to also speak about Account Aggregator, right? I think for people, you know, who unless you've not been reading about fintech, you would not know, or at least not know about Account Aggregator. So, you know, now that you've spoken about lending, you know, my question more around is, you know, there's an opportunity in lending as well. Right? You know, there's obviously people who can make money out of lending, similar to banks. I think, you know, people know that model. But, you know, there's a lot more nuance there in terms of what information about a person can lead to in terms of interest rates, in terms of having better credit scores, in terms of getting loans for lower rates, making him productive, making or at least enabling him to pay money back faster, etc. So that whole quality of loan given can be improved if there's more data. And that's what Account Aggregator is solving for. So you have data from regulators like RBI, SEBI, IRDA, PFRDA. Eventually gives you a snapshot of what a person is worth or his net worth and his financial profile. And that can help, say, at least categorize some of these loans, do these loans faster, do KYC faster maybe. But my point is, why aren't fintechs solving for this right now? For example, if there is a person who's got multiple loans, which is at like, say, 25-30% rate of interest, why aren't fintechs solving for enabling credit to this person who's, you know, maybe has amazing financial history, right? But it's not available to, say, certain lenders. Now, can't fintechs collate this information and make sure this person gets a loan at a lower rate? Is that an opportunity there? Because you're obviously cannibalizing your own business, because the lesser interest rate you facilitate a borrower, the lesser cut you get from the eventual lender. And hence, you're obviously cannibalizing a part of your business. But does that make sense in the longer run to keep customers with you? Because, you know, I think, I'm not sure how open banking has progressed in Europe and US. I think there's a lot more to be done there as well. But at least with India, the clear use case with Account Aggregator seems to be lending. So have you seen founders talk about this, that, you know, putting customer first, thinking about revenue later, which I think you touched upon as well just a while ago. Is that a mindset that Indian founders, Indian fintech are now coming into? Because that seems to be very important for the next phase of, say, growth, right? And you said next 10 years will look very different from the past 10 years. And a lot of that will be on data information and stuff like Account Aggregator. So what do you think about
it? I think there are several questions rolled into the one, but I'll try to answer them separately. There are fintech startups that are solving for that data access to some extent, right? Outside of the account aggregators. And by the way, account aggregators, as you pointed out, largely or only has data on the asset side of a person. By asset side, I mean just on the deposits that they have in their bank account, their investments, their policies, and things like that, right? The credit side of the data is still with the credit bureaus to some extent. And therefore, there are, at least that is a distinction from an account aggregator perspective. But there are startups that are solving for this account data access to another extent, which is, we've invested in two companies in this space. One is called Tartan, which is building payroll APIs specific for payrolls, right? And another company that we've invested in is called Monet, which is building a data or consumer insights infrastructure for lending as one use case, but they have many other use cases as well. And Monet, for example, has like almost 500 different data points outside of even the account aggregator data and outside of their credit data as well, right? So they're allowing lenders to provide a holistic view of that consumer to be able to lend to them, right? And Tartan, on the other hand, as well, I think this payroll API bit is so undersolved by a lot of companies in the past that the opportunity for Tartan is pretty massive. And by, as an example, there is, we've obviously seen when we take a personal loan, all our banks and fintech startups and everyone will ask us for 3 months of salary slips and payment history and all of those aspects, right? We are asked for bank statement data. So Whereas with Vitartan, you just log into your company's HRMS and the data is automatically pulled with your consent, saying that you are earning so-and-so amount, but it's directly populated by your HR of the company. So it's not even that it's manipulated by the employee to some extent. And therefore, I think there are so many problems that need to be solved on the data side of it. The other aspect that you touched upon is, can fintech startups use this kind of data to lend better to a lot of the borrowers that are there, right? And with regard to that, I think there's a question of with regard to the economics of the unit economics of a loan, right? When a fintech startup is lending to someone, to let's say me, right? When I'm borrowing from a fintech startup, the fintech startup is having a cost of that loan from the bank or the NBFC where they are borrowing from, right? And that is almost 14-15% when they are borrowing from a NBFC. Today, after all the rate hikes and all of that, it's almost 18%, right? Now, if the fintech startup is borrowing at 18%, they cannot lend to me less than 18%. That'll be foolish of them, right? And so it's kind of tough for a fintech startup to justify giving a lesser kind of interest rate, right? But then there are some unique ways in which newer startups are trying to lend by saying that, hey, I will give you an overdraft loan from a bank, which is, let's say, will come at 8-9%. And plus, I will layer on this NBFC loan as well. And together, it will be a blended cost of, let's say, 14-15%, right? So some people are trying to build that blended kind of product. The RBI themselves have been pushing for a co-lending product where the effective interest rate to the borrower is much lesser. Right, where a bank will again, let's say, lend at 8-9%, the NBFC will lend at 13-14%. My blended sort of interest rate as a borrower will be more like 10-11%. Right, so there are different ways of achieving lower interest rate, but you, as a fintech startup, they cannot lend less than what they are borrowing at, right? Because they have costs of customer acquisition, they have cost of defaults and NPAs or non-performing assets. They have a bunch of other cost of even OPEX and things like that. So it's all of that. I think it's a unit economics problem that fintech startups have at their disadvantage, really, because they're not licensed in many cases and therefore cannot borrow at lower interest rates.
No, that makes sense. And also, just to, since you touched upon co-lending, right? I think there's lots of regulations around this and lots of announcements from RBI around this. So what is happening in the co-lending space? As in, the last time I was reading about co-lending, it was more around NBFCs. I mean, say a startup has an NBFC and they're lending through NBFC, then they can also rope in a bank to kind of lend alongside. What's happening in the co-lending regulation space? Because I haven't read about it for quite some time. Maybe, you know, it's worth kind of touching upon co-lending as well.
I think co-lending is... starting out, it's small, but co-lending is basically two regulated or licensed entities lending to the same borrower, right? And the lending is done at a mix of 80% by the bank and 20% by the NBFC itself, right? Why that is done? That is basically done to, one, help banks lend without having to do the OPEX side of things or the acquiring the user and all of those aspects. The other aspect is so that the blended interest rate charged to the borrower is much lesser than what it would be if it was just by the NBFC or the non-banking financial company. And so it was launched some time back, but I think is now only starting to pick up steam where because it is in a split of 80-20% or 60-40 or 70-30, whatever the split is, the mechanics of that co-lending loan were kind of broken in the sense that in a split loan of, let's say, 80-20%, if I'm borrowing, let's say, 1,000 rupees, 800 is coming from the bank and 200 is coming from the NBFC, which entity will do the underwriting, right? Which entity will acquire, which entity will be able to which entity will bear the NPAs. There are so many different nuances and mechanics to that loan of a co-lending loan that it was kind of tough to build out initially. But then there were platforms like UBI and Knight FinTech and a bunch of others that launched their co-lending stack, which enabled banks and NBFCs or two regulated entities to be able to lend while those mechanics were kind of sorted out, right? Today, I believe a bunch of that is split in terms of the understanding that the NBFC will go out and acquire the borrower. This could be a priority sector loan to an agriculture, for example, or whichever other sector, or it could be a plain personal loan to some extent. So the arrangement is basically that when I borrow 1,000 rupees, 800 rupees will hit my bank, will hit my bank account from the bank, and 200 will hit my bank account from the NBFC, right? So there are two deposits that come into me if I'm borrowing. There are there is a blended interest rate, but I will have to pay them separately to the lenders at the back end. And therefore, there is a whole understanding from an underwriting perspective. The underwriting is agreed on by both the parties together, and therefore is worked out accordingly. So I got into too much detail about this, but let me know if you want me to step back.
And I actually had a follow-up on that. So this was on the NPA front. So now with the co-lending arrangements, do these help with reducing NPAs also? If so, how does that happen?
I don't know, to be honest. I hope it does. But I think we're too early to say on that, whether it helps reduce NPAs to some extent. I don't have a view on that.
Because we were trying to do some research on this recently, and there's no way to figure this. There's no derivative metric to go by. One thing we thought about was essentially if, let's say, a bunch of lending startups are going bust, that could be an indicator of NPAs not reducing.
Yeah.
But apart from that, there doesn't seem to be any metric out there.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any data put out about loan portfolio of co-lending or anything like that, even from an NPA perspective. I think too early to say. I don't know if it's being done in any meaningful way in terms of is it thousands of crores or hundreds of millions of dollars in disbursements yet. Don't know. So I think we're too early for that.
Talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, is there any deal you feel you've missed out on? So, bunch of developments, new startups, fintechs, at least in the lending space, have been sprouting. Anything that came your way, but you feel that you missed out on it, the one that got away?
Companies that came my way and I declined on them, I guess one would be Bank Open. From a valuation perspective, I looked at this at seed stage. And if we would have invested in that, that would be quite something. Paytm, I think, was looking at it when they were less than $1 billion in valuation. That would have been excellent. I think there's no way you can bet against VSS, for example. There's no way you can bet against Sameer Nigam and exceptional founders like these, right? But I guess I was too early in my journey of figuring out, a lot of these aspects of venture capital and investing. So missed out on those. There was M2P, which I missed out right at their seed or whatever stage. This was 25, 30 million valuation types.
So, I think I have a few more fun questions about mistakes. You'd also mentioned that earlier when UPI was launching, you were a non-believer. But could you elaborate on that? What were the things you felt could go wrong?
Sure. I thought two things. One was that UPI was something that didn't have precedent in India, right? And this was, again, pre-Jio, pre-Xiaomi days and all of those aspects, right? This was when India didn't have as many smartphones as it did today. And so I guess I just didn't have the foresight that phones would get better, smartphones would get better in terms of the cameras, right? I remember when Paytm launched their wallet and their QR code acceptance offline, right? I was like, there's no chance that the experience of scanning that thing will get better, right? But which was true back then, that the QR code scanning process was so cumbersome that I was like, yeah, this is not going to happen, right? There were so many challenges with regard to that. So I think one was the process of it, where I just didn't believe, again, my naivety to some extent, where I just didn't believe that smartphones would get better from a QR code scanning perspective, right? Cameras, again, back then were like 1-2 megapixel or something like that. And so it wasn't that great. The other thing was with regard to just the acceptance. I didn't believe that banks would adopt it or non-banks would adopt it the way it did, right? Again, this was baggage from the wallet times, where I saw that banks were losing out on the wallet game quite a lot, right? And banks were also still quite nonchalant about the fact that wallets were growing the way they were back then. This was 2014, 15 or something like that, where I used to speak with bank executives and they would be like, oh, you know, this is just a fly on the giant, and it's not going to create any dent in my business to some extent. And so I guess there was some bit of that as well, where I just thought that, you know, if banks didn't think anything about wallets, why would they think anything about UPI? And therefore, why would adoption grow for it, right? But I didn't see that non-banks would be the ones piloting UPI the way they did. And therefore, PhonePe, Google Pay, and all of these guys coming in and saying that, hey, we're, you know, building these payment rails. That was something that was kind of crazy, at least for me, when I was looking at UPI back then. The third aspect was just that it was also considered to be free for a certain period of time. And I was like, why would anyone adopt it? Or why would companies want to talk about UPI if they're not incentivized to some extent, right? So bunch of reasons why I felt that way back then.
No, it makes sense. And like these three reasons you mentioned, there's this like parallel that's happening right now, like in terms of ONDC. I wanted to ask you, because you were like a non-believer in UPI, for the same reasons, are you like a non-believer in ONDC, or is that something you now are looking at with more interest?
Yeah, I think I have my reservations regarding UPI, regarding ONDC, or Open Network for Digital Commerce. And so I'm excited about it. I hope it does work out. There are a lot of issues and incentives and all of that stuff, which the ecosystem and the entities have already seen play out with UPI, right? And are skeptical about adopting ONDC to some extent. And therefore, there are a bunch of things that need to work out for ONDC to see adoption. I've tried ordering on ONDC using one of the apps, and the experience is great. You know, it's not like an issue at all. And therefore, from a user perspective, it's great. But from a business perspective, if I'm looking to invest, I think we have some way to go. I'm excited for sure, because it's, again, a new digital public infra. And just because of my experience with UPI in the past, you know, I'm more interested to know the exact first principles basis of ONDC as well. And I don't want to get it wrong in some extent.
Yeah. So. No. So one final question on, or at least the final meaty question that we have is, you know, we've spoken about UPI, spoken about ONDC, spoken about regulation. So there's lots happening with technology as well, with OpenAI, ChatGPT, and whatnot. So, what is the lowest hanging fruits for banks at this point in time? Or is this whole advancement in technology, coming up with digital stacks, is this the beginning of the end for banks, with fintechs kind of slowly taking over, or at least, you know, chipping away with certain banking units and banking functions? Is this going to happen? Because in India, you know, we've spoken this internally as well, you know, the only mode for banks is regulations at this point in time. So, you know, will this regulation or regulatory mode, once that goes away, will there be anything to save these banks if they don't iterate fast enough, they don't move fast enough? So what should banks do at this point in time?
Loaded question, another 10-mark question. First is, I don't think regulatory arbitrage is going away. I think the RBI rightly so, is ahead of innovation to some extent. And I've always been a fanboy of RBI. I've written in my newsletter several times that I like the work that they're doing. They're right in their own way to bring about the kind of regulations that they are bringing about. And I think that they're looking at it from two aspects. One is customer protection, and the second is with regard to stability in financial services, right? Again, I've also written that financial services is only built on trust, right? Trust that consumers have in institutions, that the institution will still exist 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, even after maybe I pass away, the institution will still be there. My family will be taken care of. I will still have my deposits. Nothing is going to go wrong and things like that, right? RBI over the past few years has not let banks fail at all, right? They've figured out ways to get the banks to be acquired by another bank or to find another buyer or something like that. But RBI has always made sure that the customer deposits that are there are always safeguarded, right? And so I don't think the regulatory arbitrage is going away. Again, because RBI is doing a fabulous job at it. So then what I believe is going to happen is that fintech startups, it's actually just going to make it more expensive to start up in financial services if you are going to be a licensed entity, which is kind of going to be the norm with regard to financial services. And again, RBI wants only licensed entities to operate in financial services, again, from the perspective of building lasting institutions, not companies being founded by frivolous individuals, right, who are there tomorrow, who are there today, not there tomorrow, and to some extent. So I think there are a lot of those aspects which RBI is thinking of that now the fintech industry is starting to think about, right? We've seen more recently that a lot of fintech startups are starting to hire on board ex-RBI members, ex-SEBI members. All of these fintech startups are starting to build those advisory councils from ex-regulators, right? Fintech startups are also starting to beef up their board with non-investor board members as well, right? People from the financial services industry. All of this stuff is a maturing of our financial services, fintech sort of fintech industry in a way, right? Which is all great things. The industry had to mature and is happening now, right? So it's only going to be a matter of time that RBI believes that fintech is not just a child's play, right? And therefore, it is going to be thought of and built by people that are people with integrity and people that want to build lasting businesses, right? So there are all of those aspects which I think is happening, and the fintech industry is already going in that direction, right? It just makes it easier, more difficult to sort of start up, but I think we'll get there at some point in time.
We've also compiled like a bunch of fun questions for you. I mean, that's how you want to like end this. So
let's do this.
So what's the craziest like pitch you've received from like a startup paper?
Again, we'll never forget this. But have you seen the movie War Dogs?
I haven't. But yeah,
okay. Anyway, the movie War Dogs is about two young guys in their early 20s becoming arms dealers and end up selling arms to the US government.
Yeah, I think I see it now, right? That you like, defined the story.
Yeah. Excellent story. Has Jonah Hill and another guy. Beautiful story. but what I was getting at is that one of the founders that I ended up speaking to, and I'm just thinking whether I'm breaking any NDAs over here, but likely not. Anyway, my point was that one of the founders I spoke to was building a company with regard to smart clocks, right? And this founder on the call ends up telling me that he was imprisoned in the US because he was found with, you know, substances. And therefore, in prison, he ends up meeting one of the war dogs, right? One of the guys that was selling those arms. And that was a crazy pitch. I think not from a business perspective, but just like the founder background.
Did you end up in?
And apparently the guy from, yeah, clearly not. But apparently the guy from who he met in prison is actually was investing in his company back then, and so just exciting stuff.
So, like, well, you mentioned UPI was like maybe a mistake, but in terms of like investment decisions, what's the biggest mistake that you feel you've made?
Biggest mistake? I think
it could be like,
yeah, there were two things I think that I have made as an investor. One is about falling in love with the founders, or rather, I mean, not literally falling in love, but basically really liking the founders and my rapport with them and things like that. And just basically saying, hey, founder, you know, I will just back you with whatever you're doing. And so that's one mistake that I think I've made in the past. Another mistake is me thinking that I will invest in this product or this company because this is a solution that I want to see in the world, right? So it's kind of an emotional mistake that I make, I've made in the past where, and probably still will, is about, you know, me thinking or forcing onto the world what I believe should exist in the world, whereas that never works out. And that's an emotional way to invest. And over the years, I've realized this and I've stopped, or rather controlled myself from being emotional about the kind of investments that I end up making, right? So those, I think, were the two main mistakes, I guess.
So what about the most impressive startup you've come across in the last year or so?
Yeah, we've invested in them.
Do you want to like name anyone?
I think a lot of the companies that we've invested in, one is called Flash, which is building a consumer identity or an email identity for commerce specifically, started by Ranjit Boyanapalli, was one of the senior VPs at Flipkart. And I'm very excited about that. I was very excited even before it launched, largely because, again, with Ranjit, he has been at the epicenter of e-commerce in India, right? He's basically helped define what e-commerce looks like in India, right? And for him to come out of Flipkart and say that I will launch something so radically different from what is being done in commerce was something that I was really excited by, right? So Ranjit and Flash was one opportunity. Excited about Monet as well, building this whole consumer insights infrastructure for companies. Monet has been killing it with regard to their product. Before, again, the founders over there had such good reputation in the market that even before they launched, they already had paying customers because of the reputation of the founders over there. And now they're doing exceptionally well. Monet, Tartan is another company that's doing really well. So many of these kind of companies that that are just so exciting, building things differently is why, I mean, those are some of the companies that we've invested in that I think are exceptional.
And speaking of like all these like big major builds that keep happening, the developments that keep happening, technology emerging, apart from the spaces where you take an active interest in and invest in as well, how do you, if you do, keep up with the trends like across the board, which could have an impact on like, again, the space where you're investing? Is there
it's tough.
Ritual? Is there something that you follow as part of your routine?
There's no right answer to this, unfortunately. I was just thinking that ChatGPT was launched by OpenAI in November 2022, last year, right? And I started getting excited about generative AI only like 2 months back or so, right? So I think for me, my first instinct is to dismiss what becomes the current thing to some extent, you know? And so, but then, because it helps me then take a step back and think and rethink and all of those aspects, right? So I think just intuitively take a step back from those current thing kind of aspects and really think from a first principles basis and then just read up as much as I can about it. But there's no real answer. There's a lot of things that I fall short of. So
I think that approach also helps. I mean, that would be the con, maybe it takes time to get up to date on something. But the good part is, because there are so many things getting thrown at you every single day, everything is a news item. The first reaction being a skeptical reaction sort of frees up mind space a bit. So you're able to like focus on what you know to be important right now for sure. And then maybe if something actually turns out to be significant, you can always catch up.
Just closing off on that, I don't believe I'm skeptical about the technologies themselves, or I'm not skeptical about the stacks that are being launched and things. So I'm not skeptical about it. I just don't believe that the rate of adoption will be the way we in tech think it will be, right? The adoption of, let's say, generative AI, for example, I think will not be evenly distributed. It will be distributed maybe really fast in the US, but in India, it'll take its own time because India has its own nuances. And within India, in different sectors, the different sectors will have their different adoption rates as well, right? Or their distribution rates. So I believe that, I'm not skeptical. I just don't believe that me wasting my time in obsessing over it at that moment makes sense for my mental bandwidth, right? I am excited about AI. I recently transferred my blog and my stuff to a new domain. And so while I was transitioning it, I realized that I've been writing about AI since like 2015, 16, right? And so I was like, damn, why don't I remember all of these things, you know? So I, again, from a technology lens as an engineer and all of those aspects, I'm very excited about new technologies, but just not, I'm skeptical, I guess, about the distribution of it or the adoption rate of it.
So one last question I have before Dinesh like gets to his set. What do you think is the most common misconception about a VC?
Misconception, huh? Interesting. I think the main misconception, and this might be a little controversial, is that VCs are smart. Some of the best are really smart. And don't get me wrong, very few people are the best, right? They are exceptional at their craft and their game. But majority of the investors, majority of the VCs, are just borrowing their learnings and borrowing it from founders. And so when I see founders asking VCs, hey, what should I build? What do you think about this sector? Should I do this? Should I do that? I'm like, you know, you're wasting your time with a VC because the VC is only borrowing their information and their learnings from other founders and just regurgitating what they've heard from someone else. And so very few people actually across the industry and just how I guess as humans work, very few people actually put their mind to things or even think for themselves. A lot of us, and it's become a lot easier now in social media to borrow hot takes from WhatsApp, from what other people are sort of tweeting and saying and all of those things, right? So very few people actually put their mind to it and really think for themselves. And therefore, I think that's just one misconception that I don't like seeing founders do of like going and thinking that, hey, this VC is really smart and so I should learn from them about whatever. The other thing is, I think VC as a profession is just very glamorized, right? It's not so glamorous. Not every VC travels first class. Not every VC is like owning the latest car. Not every VC is living in a mansion and all of those things. The life is not glamorous. The work that you have to end up putting in is very monotonous, very dry, very boring, very the validation cycles are long. So if you want to survive in VC, if you're looking for instant gratification, you're not going to make it, right? So there are a lot of aspects about VC that are just so boring and terrible that I think what is in become the public perception about VCs is just so wrong.
So a bunch of questions that I have. The first one is, What's the best piece of advice you ever received, even generally also, like not just as a VC, but generally?
I can't remember right now.
Okay. So we'll give that a pass and maybe we'll come back to it. So with, say, I think you just said, going back to your previous answer, that, you know, as a VC, there's a lot more work that you put in to figure out, you know, where you got to invest and where you don't want to invest. So what's the one, say, very important red flag for you? I know there are a lot of obvious answers to it, but if you have any unconventional red flag in terms of how you evaluate companies, if there's one that maybe will be useful for some of the emerging managers out there.
My main red flag is if I'm asking a question about numbers and I receive, you know, a qualitative response, that is like a big red flag to me. Like if I'm asking someone about a simple thing like how many customers you've spoken to, and I receive anything other than, I've spoken to, well, at least 24 customers, then it's a red flag to me. Then that just means that either the founder is not thinking quantitatively in terms of, you know, I need to think about it mathematically or I need to think about it economically. Then it's all about narrative and it's all about a lot of the other aspects of venture building that in my view, don't make sense.
Got it. And, you know, the next question may have some conflict of interest, but, you know, I'll vouch for FinTech Insight. But apart from your newsletter, so, you know, which other, say, newsletter, blog or book or a podcast, maybe just one out of the bunch that you follow, would you recommend to somebody who wants to keep up with the FinTech space?
Sure. Well, the FinTech space, unfortunately, I don't think too many people do a really good job at it. But some of the people that do a really good job of assimilating their own thoughts and writing it down in a newsletter format or whatever, at least from a newsletter perspective, I read The India Notes by Dharmesh Ba. I read Tiger Feathers by Rahul Sanghi and Aryaman Veer. I read FinTech Brain Food by Simon Taylor. Those are the three main ones I think that I follow rather more religiously than the others. The others are kind of infrequent to some extent. I think, Dinesh, you started posting more recently, more frequently on your LinkedIn, at least not on newsletter. So that's, I think, helps me think outside of just the private or the early stage investing side of things and more economical and more public markets and all of those aspects. I listen to podcasts a lot. I'm on podcasts all the time. When I'm walking, when I'm taking a lift or whatever else, so I listen to a lot of podcasts. FinTech specific ones I try to keep away from, but I listen to the Tim Ferriss Show. I listen to the All In podcast. I listen to a whole bunch of them, just far too many such podcasts.
The final question in this series that I have is, apart from FinTech, which other industry are you most excited about? Maybe unfair question since you follow mostly FinTech, but still wanted to know.
Interesting. This is a tough one. Outside of FinTech, the benefit of FinTech actually is that FinTech is kind of horizontal. And so I quite like the healthcare space and applications of FinTech in healthcare. I'm also interested in the travel space and the applications again of FinTech in the travel space. I think if you look at the travel space over the past 10 years, there's not been a single major innovation in that space, right? And I think that space is waiting to be disrupted in a large way. There's a lot to be done in that space as well. And by travel, I mean not just your Uber, Ola type ride hailing stuff, general other aspects as well. So there's those two, I think I would say, are the two main ones.
Okay. So one final question. So what's the kindest thing anybody has done for you?
A lot of people do a lot of kind things for me. I think right from the first job that I got, they were extremely kind. Shagun Kapoor over there, Samir Varma, Dhaval Agarwal, all of these guys allowed me to make mistakes, allowed me to fail, allowed me to do all of those aspects and just learn and improve, right? I think they were very kind to me. Throughout my career, a lot of my colleagues have been very kind again because I don't come from a financial background. And so I still being able to, you know, listen to my view or whatever else. There's been a bunch of things. I think every step of the way, there have been people that have just been kind to me. And even now, I think people just think of me when, you know, they want to talk to someone and they just call me, and, you know, just people being kind every day. So it's just a blessing.
No, thanks so much, Osborne. It's really nice having you on the show.
Thank you so much, Dinesh, Mohit. Appreciate it.